I should begin. I'm Andrew Bruce, the IOM Regional Director. Would you like to introduce yourself, sir?
My name is Lutfi Rauf, Indonesian Ambassador to the Kingdom of Thailand. I've been here for months. Nice to see you all. Good morning. Thank you.
So will you introduce yourself? Sorry.
My name is Wargana Pinggadin, the Secretary of Indonesian Embassy. Thank you.
In charge of consular matters.
I'm Khalil Rahman from World Health Organization.
Evening,
Morning,
I'm Diana, the Secretary of
Ben Harkins, and I'm a researcher at the Asian Research Center for Migration.
Good morning, everyone. My name is João Freitas de Câmara, Ambassador of Timor-Leste to the Kingdom of Thailand, Cambodia, Laos.
Good morning, Yuko Hamada, IOM.
Good, thank you everyone, and I'll make some opening remarks. The Ambassador of Indonesia, the Ambassador of Timor-Leste, distinguished members of the Diplomatic Corps, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It is my distinct pleasure to welcome you all here today to the fifth of our In Brief series, this one focusing on strengthening pre-departure orientation programs in Indonesia, Nepal and the Philippines. And we are particularly pleased to have the Indonesian ambassador as our lead discussant today. As many of you are aware, this series of paper deals with different aspects of labour migration in the region. Today we focus on providing information to migrant workers prior to departure in order to, amongst other things, help them work in a different culture and to protect themselves from exploitation. As was highlighted in the fourth in the series on the recruitment of workers, there are many people out there looking for ways to exploit labour migrants at all stages of the migration cycle. Many workers have a low level of education and in their haste to find a job abroad are susceptible to being tricked and even in extreme cases trafficked. The challenge for governments is to prevent this kind of exploitation, and one measure that will contribute to that is the provision of information. While the focus of the paper we will discuss today is on providing information that will help workers function effectively in their countries of destination, there is also a need to get reliable information to prospective labour migrants earlier in the migration cycle. IOM has 60 years of experience delivering pre-departure orientation programs and has done so to more than 1 million migrants. The aim of many of these programs, particularly for permanent settlers, is to hasten their integration into their new communities. Much of the focus is on understanding and functioning in the host society, and that is also one of the key focuses of pre-departure orientation for labour migrants, to be able to adapt, live, and work effectively in a very different culture. A lot more needs to be done in this area to better prepare workers to work and live abroad. And the paper we will discuss here today looks at how Indonesia, the Philippines and Nepal approach this issue and lays out some ideas on how further improvements can be made. So without further ado, I will ask Ms. Yuko Hamada, IOM's Senior Regional Labour Migration and Migration for Development Specialist, to present the key findings of this paper. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Good morning, everybody. Today is the fifth issue in brief, and unfortunately, we don't have authors who wrote this excellent paper. So this paper was written by Dr. Maruja, who is from Scalabrini. I know her very well. She's a really excellent researcher, that actually from the region. And also Ms. Dublin Aguinas, who was actually seconded to IOM until the end of August and went back to the Migration Policy Institute. And two of them are very well-established researchers. They wrote this wonderful article, and I am here just to present some findings. But before getting into the author's findings, I want to go through the principal element of the pre-departure orientation. I want to ask you, how many of you are familiar with pre-departure orientations? Or many of you? How many of you received pre-departure orientations? Oh, wow. How many of you conducted pre-departure orientations? So now you see there are a lot of knowledge and experiences here, and I want to have these, you know, experiences, knowledges, and opinions to be brought up after, you know, this presentation and the discussions, the presentations. My interesting encounter with pre-departure orientation was when I was in Pakistan. 5 years ago, they were, as a matter of fact, discussing with Italy on the MOU, on the seasonal migrant worker scheme. So they were approaching to IOM if we can help develop some materials. What they wanted to do was that they want to equip their nationals with their basic language skills, country's information, cultural information, what's taboo, what's not. Of course, Sylvia can tell that, there are a big difference in cultural, including cultural, that the Pakistan and Italy have difference too. But most importantly, the Pakistan was very keen to learn about legal aspects of Italy, and wanted to provide information for their nationals to be aware of what kind of legal aspects of that their national can be aware of. So the protection issue is the fundamental element of pre-departure orientation, which serve as a protection tool for migrants, provide accurate and timely information, and help migrants develop realistic expectations about working in countries of destination, and also develop the skills and awareness necessary for successful adaptation to the society and working environment, as well as gender mainstreaming. Those are the principal elements of the objective of the pre-departure orientation. When we talk about pre-departure orientation, it is important to think about four aspects. What kind of information deliver, when, how, and to whom. Globally, I would like to also introduce the term, and I'm sure that many of you are very aware of the pre-employment program. So in addition to pre-departure orientation, pre-employment program is more focused on the information on the employment, while and also targeted to migrant workers, where pre-departure orientations covers other kind of migrants, and also the topics they cover actually are those who are not necessarily related to the employment, but the life aspects. And the important aspect is when to disseminate information. Of course, it is important to propose pre-departure courses to migrant workers who are about to leave for their job abroad. But most importantly, it is also important to disseminate information before workers have secure contract. So what pre-employment programs cover? They cover wages, employment standards for specific occupations and countries, skills testing procedures, health examination services and their fees, information on private recruitment agencies, including blacklisted recruiters. For some countries in the region, it becomes very important. Also on information on immigration clearance, list of countries recommended. How do they convey this program through seminars? Many countries in this region, they have so-called this migrant resource centers that provide information to migrants anytime, anywhere. Also, information campaigns and other means through public media, nowadays soft media, can be also considered. And this can be very useful when they are targeted to less skilled, less educated young women and also migrant family members. The pre-departure orientation courses, basically they cover rights and responsibilities, work and life conditions in countries of destination, conditions of admission and stay under relevant immigration laws, travel documents information, airport procedures, and other travel tips, health awareness, cultural differences and means of dealing with them. And they are often provided by the government authorities and sometimes NGOs, including the countries of destinations. Options and procedures for sending remittance, this is also an important topic, in addition to language training, as well as information on return and reintegration. Now, getting back to this fifth issue in brief, the authors talk about 3 points that can be discussed here: characteristic, good practices, challenges, and areas for improvement. They actually talk about 3 countries, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Nepal. And the common thing about these 3 countries, they all make pre-departure orientation as compulsory. It's written in the legal, according to this paper. That makes this program very sustainable and gives scope to improve. But the difference of these 3 countries are actually who implement. In case of Indonesia, the government implements in urban and rural areas, and that makes the fee to participate in this program free of charge. While the Philippines, they have multi-stakeholder approach, which is that government organizes this training in addition to more than 260 accredited civil societies, private sector, mainly the recruitment agencies. But there is a criticism to it, particularly on the recruitment agencies conduct programs, because how do they promote human rights issues when there is a business of recruitment? So in the Philippines, there are a lot of discussions in it. Interesting thing about the Philippines is that the NGO takes care of the pre-departure orientations for the domestic workers. Now, in the case of Nepal, 100% is done by the recruitment agencies, and the fees, therefore, is a little bit higher than other countries. On the curriculum, what kind of topics that they are covering? 3 countries, they have very structured pre-departure orientation programs. Covering the country's profiles, law, cultures, and customs, employment contracts, rights and responsibilities, remittance, safe banking system. The interesting features that I have found was that some each country is making effort to actually reflect the priorities of the migrants. So, interesting, the topic that Indonesia covers, self-confidence coaching to deal with culture shock, stress, loneliness, and professional issues. The Philippines, they cover migration reality, code of conduct, possible changes. Now, this issue in brief, talk about key challenges, and I'm not going to go through each one of them, but what I think is very important is that because the labor migration is constantly changing and evolving, the program should also, you know, capture all these emerging problems and adapt them into their program. I think that is the key challenges on that. And behind the key challenges, there are successful where there are some secrets. And one of the important points that the authors raised was the create orientation program aiming at the recruitment agency. I think that is one of the area that the region can improve a lot, because the role of the recruitment agencies in the play is very increasingly important in this region. Finally, the authors point out three recommendations, but I would like to add that the importance of reflecting migrants' voice. And this can be done through the evaluation system or monitoring system to capture what migrants have experienced, what are the problems. Having been involved in the programs, what it worked and what's not. So this information should be adapted and actually feed it back to the designer of the program, pre-departure orientation program. And I think that is the most important recommendation that I would like to add. And I would like to pass over to Andy. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Yuko, for outlining a number of the important issues there. Who is providing the training, and then the question is how effective that training is, how well it's being provided, I think are important issues. And also the last point about making sure that there's a feedback loop so that we know what was important when the workers arrived on the ground, which part of the training that had really been useful and which wasn't, and trying to make sure that we make the training as useful as we possibly can. Moving on to the next speaker, I'm very, very happy that to be able to welcome Ambassador Ralph of Indonesia to be able to be here with us today. There's a short biography of the ambassador and in your packages, and it outlines his distinguished career in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Indonesia. I was also happy to note he spent quite a number of years in my home country, New Zealand. Seven years. So that's very nice. So without further ado, if I could ask you, Ambassador, to make some commentary on this issue. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's very good morning. Great pleasure to be here. Invited to become one of the panelists, I think, of discussions. Yes. It is therefore, thank you very much. As you have mentioned in the presentations before, one of the countries mentioned here is Indonesia. It is true, Indonesia sends great numbers of migrant workers in many countries overseas, of course. If we are talking about a number of Indonesian migrant workers, there are two categories, formal and informals. The formal ones we are not encountering significant problems in this because they are better prepared. We are talking about the programs of pre-departures and others, relevance and sufficient knowledge about their future works. The second one is informal one. This is creating a lot of problems because it's not what, we expected. Although, for instance, the percentage is not very significant comparing to the total numbers of migrants, workers overseas. For your data, and based on the data I have, because I'm dealing with this issue also as DG for Consular Affairs, which is responsible also for my national citizens protections overseas, officially, the Indonesian citizens living abroad, including in this migrant workers, around 3.5 million. But we firmly believe that the real number is even two times above this. We anticipate around 6.5 million. And there are two countries where our migrant workers are concentrating, Middle East. And Middle East, again, we can single out Saudi Arabia, receiving the largest one. And of course, in Southeast Asia, Malaysia. We have a colleague from Malaysia, know, I think, better than I do. We have around more than 1 million. For simple reasons, the proximity is very close. So I'm talking about just a kind of backgrounds, informal migrant workers, because we have problems in this. The problems, I have to admit, the root cause is mainly in Indonesia, because starting from the recruitment process and also other related issues. If we're talking about the recruitment process, starting from the village level and to the national, I mean, if you're looking at the Indonesian map, it's a big country, 17,000 islands, and the recruitment process starts in the village levels. There's a lot of problems there, education, the poverty, and so on, so I don't need to explain because the time constraint. As a matter of fact, as you mentioned in this report, the government of Indonesia has passed the law, which is quite sufficient in terms of the substance of the law itself. One of them, I think, is law number 39, specially designed for the migrants' protections overseas. The problem is, again, we are lacking of way in implementing it. So many challenges. As I say before, the former one is not very difficult, and the second one is that related to the regulations and other regulations and law, we also clearly define that the country of destination should have one, a kind of agreement with the Indonesian government. The second one, that country should have sufficient law, domestic law, that can protect the migrant workers. And unfortunately, as I mentioned before, in the Middle East, this kind of things almost absent. But in the country like in Asia, for instance, in Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Taiwan, we have a kind of MOU or the law that's sufficient enough to protect the migrant workers. In Malaysia, of course, we have also bigger problems before. But I think last year or 2 years ago, we managed to conclude agreements, MOU. I myself not know a detail about this, but this is part of a measures that the government carrying out to minimize the problems of our migrant workers that encountering problems overseas. If we're talking about migrant workers within Indonesia's context, we have to recognize that this is closely related to businesses. There's a lot of stakeholders involved in this. Unfortunately, some part of these stakeholders are part of the problems. It's not part of the solutions. You mentioned in your reports, one of them is agents. We call it chalo, in fact, a kind of middleman. They are very active in operating in the village levels by misleading, spreading information that contains all rosy pictures, the beauty of working overseas, you know. I mean, you can imagine if we have the society, the peoples who are not well educated, they can be easily influenced to be part of this. And then this is the problem starting, because the first one, if they want to work, of course they have to perform the duty based on the best ability they have. The second one's physically fit to work. This is where the loopholes happen. A lot of corruption practices by way of collusions between the authorities. I have to be frank about this. And of course, by informant of the big company, the labor supply agency. That's why in Indonesia there are, of course, I have to admit also, we have to recognize also, that there's a lot of professionals, manpower agency, which is organized and sanctioned by the governments through a different organization, associations. On the other hand, there's also a lot of individuals, brokers or agency that unfortunately abuse the systems. So if we're talking about business sides, these professional ones in many cases are the losers, because they cannot compete. They follow all the procedures, spending a lot of money, investing on you mentioned about the education program and so on and so forth, while the illegal one, this is just doing try to make a profit without respecting or without obeying or adhering to the existing law, just for the sake of making a lot of profits. In many occasions, I argue very strongly if we have a meeting about this. But again, you know, if people just think about the profits, nobody cares. They don't want to care. No matter how we strongly, criticize them or warning them, but they might sometimes follow, but by the time goes, they come back again to the old practices. This is one of the challenges we have, law enforcement. And the second one is overlapping between the institutions. I mean, Minister of Manpower, and you mentioned also before BNP do TKI, we call it National Board for Placement and Protection of Indonesian Overseas Workers. It's overlapping. It is therefore now the Parliament want to amend the law number 4, 2000, because it's within this law, it is only the business sites are contained in this. But very few articles and provision in this law are related to the migrant workers' protection. And this is the Parliament now want to have this change. And I have a opportunity also to be invited by Parliament to give my submissions. So this is a kind of pictures that I would like to slightly mention in this. Now, of course, the governments encountering these problems almost every year. It is therefore Indonesian government realized that prevention is much better than cure. It is easy say than done. If you're looking at again concerning about the pre-departure programs, we are very clear in our law. For instance, for pre-departure programs, we have a training compulsory according to the law, 200 hours minimum for education, for training, and so on and so forth. And then before that, also before, after that, before they depart, there is a kind of briefing also, normally 2 days or 20 hours. This is according to the law and regulations. There has been practices by these professionals and legals, manpowers or workers agencies. And then they carry out these programs at least 2 days before the departures to the country of destinations. During this briefing, of course, you mentioned also in your reports, very, very right, that contains about laws and regulations, cultures, custom, and the climate in the country of destination, procedures of departure from origin country to the country of destinations, the role of Indonesian mission abroad is very important, because in our constitutions, the governments is obliged. It's clearly defined in the constitution, say it is the duty of the state to protect its citizens. So that's why our migrant workers before they depart should be given also a kind of briefing about the functions, the informations about Indonesian missions abroad, embassy, consulate, and so forth and so forth. This is because we need to have easy access for them. In many countries, we don't have a problem. In Hong Kong, we don't have a problem. In Singapore, we don't have a problem. In Korea, Japan, we don't have a problem. In Taiwan, we don't have a problem. We have a big problem in the Middle East because part of the cultures. There is a culture in Middle East, especially where they don't have a kind of domestic laws sanctioning about their obligations vis-à-vis the migrant workers. There's a kind of cultures. When you enter my household, you are belong to me. And nobody can interfere that. This is the problem. It is therefore we asking, we call our all members to be proactive, providing all informations that can be easily accessed to those. But again, it's not easy because sometimes the way of communicating with our embassy is sometimes blocked or whatever reasons cannot be that easy. Another one is how to claim the insurance. Embassy also have a very big role in this, including those who are whose salary are not paid. Because sometimes this is related one to another, starting from the, you know, the recruitment process. We have a high percentage of the cases where these migrant workers' salaries are not paid, even up to 8 months to even more than 1 year. I tried to find out this why. Apparently, the salary are considered, calculated as a part of the production cost during the recruitment process, because you rightly mentioned in your report, the agency, the child of middlemen, from the beginning start to allure, to tempt the people in the village, look, don't need to worry about the cost for your, let's say, pre-departure cost. We will pay for you. You mentioned from various numbers, 5 million, even something more than that. And then starting that, from that period, they considered that you are in debt already. And then you can repay when you work. And sometimes, unfortunately, in many countries, the salaries are far below the minimum wage. This is in many countries in the Middle East. I'm sorry to say this. Even if we have colleagues from Middle East, I'm sorry to say it. This is as many, how to call it, facts. That this is a kind of manifestation of modern slavery. I have to say this, because I'm sparing this. Of course, we cannot blame those countries. We have to blame ourselves, I mentioned before, because mostly of the root cause is starting in our country. And the government is working hard to improve them. And I'll show you, based on your report, how these programs, the government's measures start to work. So another one is how to get medical advice. That's why it's very compulsory for us, before our migrant workers depart, they have to have a medical test as a kind of compulsory for them to work, so to confirm they are fit to work. And this is also a lot of loopholes, because the size of the country is so big. Sometimes, you know, just formalities, rubber stamp, but in reality didn't happen. And this is also happened because, for instance, I have experience in one of the embassy from Middle East in Jakarta. They can easily get issue a visa, even the documents for visa are not very, you know, convincingly original. In some cases, I found medical certificates, only one page, got a nexus with the list of names. And then based on the documents, this embassy issued a visa. It's a quite, that's why I'm asking that embassy ambassador, look, where's the logic? If I want to travel to your country, I need to fulfill these documents, even I'm a diplomat, by using my diplomatic passport. It takes me 2 weeks to wait for a visa. Well, this was a lot of questions about the legality of documents, yet you can give them visa easily. So this is kind of the facts I can share with you. We don't need to, but this is the situation. So another one is how to overcome shock, cultural shock. This has happened. For instance, the people in Java, they are peoples who are always very gentle. Even if they speak, unlike from my regions, from eastern part of Indonesia, they speak loudly sometimes. That's why I say I'm belong to the Buginese tribe from the east, not good as a diplomat. The Javanese peoples, very soft, soft-spoken. You can imagine if they work in the cultures of Middle East and Arab. You know, people's culture is very tough, very strong. Shouting probably. If they're shouting 2 or 3 times, they probably think they are insulted or they are harassed and so on and so forth. This is kind of, it is kind of environment where they find themselves in a very difficult situation. Even they have a contract sometimes, 2 years. They cannot sustain this environment. And only 3 months, they run away. And coming to the embassy seeking protection. As I say, according to the constitution, we have to accommodate and shelter them. But according to the obligations they have, the contract they have, they breached the law in that country. That's why we have a very big problems in Jordan now. Virtually taken a hostage, because they cannot be given an exit permit to leave the country. So this is again also homesickness. And then returning procedures, of course, signing working agreements. That's why in many cases they just sign a papers without knowing what's in it. This is the problem. There's another one that we need to inform them sufficiently, clearly, that they have to make sure what they are signing for. Because within these contracts about the salary, the obligation, responsibility, and so on and so forth. This is, I think, the measures that the governments put in place. As I say, in many cases works, but in some other cases didn't work, because the natures of the how to call it, the peoples who are involved in this. Another one is that the measures that we carrying out now, the governments make it very clear to reduce the problems that been encountering by our citizens overseas, is especially in Middle East or in the countries where we don't have a kind of MOU, or the country don't have sufficient law, domestic law for migrant workers. We impose what we call moratorium. In Malaysia, I think before we reach this MOU, we have a moratorium to ensure that we don't send our migrant workers, if we don't have these two things. Also in Saudi Arabia. But again, you see, this is a big problem, sir. Like in Jordan, we impose moratoriums, but our people keep coming in, because at that country they have what we have, a kind of fish on a rifle. And then it is impossible for the government to prevent our citizen traveling, because it is against the basic human rights. They are free to travel wherever they want. They are free to travel to seek a better life wherever they want. This is the problem. So even we have this policy, the people's coming, because in that country didn't recognize about our policy, because the demands, they are so high. Especially in the Middle East, they like the workers from Indonesia, because they are obedient, they are not very demanding, very easy in terms of religious, they share the same belief. And in many cases also, this poor man has misled. Hey, if you are working in Middle East, in Saudi Arabia for instance, and it's a kind of honor for you if you work in the family of the descendant of Muhammad, Prophet Muhammad. This is a kind of things irrational, but that's why you're kind of submissive. If they are maltreated, they just see. It's an unfortunate situation. So another one, of course, we start to restrengthen our legals, and then try to simplify the mechanisms, including to reduce the overlapping roles between the Minister of State agencies. If you look at in the data, although still a lot of work need to be done to prevent this, if looking at this, the data, annual deployment of migrant workers, and you mentioned also in your papers that it is true, yeah, in 2006 Indonesia's projected to send migrant workers 1 million overseas every year until 2009. It wasn't materialized. Why? Because this kind of thing still persists. The government make it clear, as long as the procedures, as long as we don't have kind of agreements, sufficient domestic law that in favoring to the migrant workers overseas, we don't send over. That's why we impose a kind of moratorium, so on and so on. That's why you look at the data, compared to the three countries, Philippines increasing. 26, 2006, 2007, 8, 9, increasing. Likewise, a little bit change in Nepal, but Indonesia declining, especially for the last, I believe on 2011 or so, because we impose tough measures. Many people say, Indonesia, look, in the 3.5 officially, migrant workers overseas, all over the world, only sorry upon some things have a problems, but again, it is true. If you're talking about 3.5 million less than even 1 or 2%. It's a big numbers, especially if they have to end up in jail, they have to end up in the execution like we have in Saudi Arabia, especially if they end up in our different shelters in many countries. It's a big problem. And then it's also become a political issue in our country. So this data show that the government measures start to work. We will not push our target to send our migrant workers if they are not well and better prepared. It is therefore also the government start to build up a kind of training centers in many provinces. As I say, it's not easy. The size of the country is so big, 17,000 islands, flying from east to the west, non-stop 7 hours. The continent country is easy, but the islands country is very difficult, but I'm not saying that it cannot be improved. We're working hard to improve it, but we need extra efforts, we need extra resources. And with your help also in improving the capacity of the stakeholders in Indonesia, it's very greatly welcome. That's what I say. I remember when I was a DG in charge of this, we have a program with your office in Jakarta, the kind of capacity buildings, also I believe information disseminations. That's what we are looking forward to continue this cooperation, because it cannot be dealt with only one country. This is also cross-boundary issues. Mm-hmm. Of course, we have to admit, and I don't hesitate to repeat again, the root cause of the problem starts at home. Thank you very much.
But thank you very much, Ambassador, for your insightful and frank remarks. I think you covered a lot of issues in extremely interesting. I must say, at one point in my career, I thought the only way to fix the problem was we wouldn't have any more labour migration in the world. But unfortunately, it's not going to happen. A country like Indonesia, for example, with an economy booming, and maybe 10, 15 years, Indonesia will actually be able to employ all of its own citizens. But there'll always be some country in the world that can't employ all of its own citizens, and there will be labour migration. And when we look at the demographics of Europe, and of course even Thailand and Japan, clearly there's going to have to be labour migration in the world. And so we've got these enormous challenges, and I thank you for laying out a lot of those challenges very clearly. It's interesting to note that small communities have often been asked if they'd rather not have the brokers that rip everybody off in their communities there, and they say, no, well, we have to have the brokers, because if we want to get a job abroad, we need brokers. So it's, even though there's a recognition that these people are there and making money from them. The other point about not receiving wages for 1 year, it seems that from what I gather in this region, it's almost about 1 year's salary in advance to get, often just simply to get your name on the list, because there's such a huge supply and a smaller demand. So about 1 year's salary before you actually start making money. And that ties back with the whole health issue, because you arrive in the country and then they do another health check and they find you've got TB or HIV, and they send you straight home, and your investment of 1 year and your family's selling buffalo, selling land is all gone up in smoke. You've got nothing. But because people are so keen to go, they get this medical exam, which may actually be the only medical exam that's offered, and doesn't end up, in fact, finding any medical conditions at all. Anyway, let me stop there, and And again, thank you, Ambassador. And let's open the floor now for comments, questions to the Ambassador, questions to others in the room. So who would like to start?
I just would like to add that you mentioned about the cost.
Okay.
In fact, Indonesia also have a cost structures, but it was not it was applied in a different forms. You mentioned earlier, you know, some pay 1 million, some pay 5 million, and so on and so forth, plus, you know. I would like to put a little bit, so to reduce the dependence of the migrant workers, the potential migrant workers before they leave, they depart. 2 years ago or 3 years ago, the president launched by involving banking sectors to help, asking the banks to provide microfinance, so they don't need to in debt before they leave in a proportionate level. This is another one that the government now also put in place as a policy, so that those who want to travel overseas to prepare the documents and other costs before they leave, they can get assistance from the banks with the very low interest, of course, because this is cost structures very high in Indonesia. For instance, from the East Nusa Tenggara, just traveling to Jakarta, it's quite long distance.
Yeah.
And then they cannot depart instantly. They have to stay in Jakarta and stay in the shelters or training center for, and they have to eat, they have a basic needs. This is already counted as a part of the production of the company.
Mm-hmm.
So a kind of speedometer starting from day one already running, and it start to be calculated. That's why this is a kind of a fact I just want to say to you about the problems we have.
Yes, please.
Thank you for organizing this kind of seminars. Very often and very useful, and we really appreciate IOM's role in structuring this labor migration. I have perhaps one or two questions and some comments. As the Ambassador of Indonesia rightly said, the problem mostly and basically is lying in the sending countries. My question is that when this migration is done by the government, as the government starts up, many things are already taken care of. But in many countries, including my own country, Bangladesh, many recruiting agencies, they are the main recruiting people by the government, and except perhaps for South Korea and some other countries. You know, for other countries, this is done by the private recruiting agencies. So how this free departure orientation seminar is organized? I mean, what is the role of the government there? Is there any obligation by the private recruiting agency to organize this free departure orientation seminar? What is the role IOM plays? Suppose you Ambassador has said something, is seeking medical advice. And one of the recommendations here, it says that it is better if we can seek the cooperation of the receiving country in the orientation seminar. When perhaps the government, it is easy to involve the receiving country. When it is done by a private recruiting agency, for a private company in the receiving country, I think the things is not really that organized. So, how these areas can be taken care of, and how IOM can involve the receiving country, even when the migration is being organized or done by the private recruiting agency for private companies in the receiving countries. About this medical advice, as Ambassador has said, I think This should be linked with the second country's participation in the orientation seminar. Because not only they can see how the workers are prepared to fly, whether they are medically fit, physically fit, perhaps they can also talk about how the basic medical services would be provided in the receiving countries when they go there. Because I think this is one of the main areas, I mean, not only the other human rights aspects, the health aspects is very important. So if we can involve the receiving countries in the universal orientation seminar, they should talk about what kind of health services, medical services these workers can get once they land there. We are happy that you know we are doing a lot of works for WHO, and the basic health areas are covered in the orientation seminar. But one important issue, I think this is also for the seminar countries, the smoking component is very important, because you know, these poor workers, they I think do smoking a lot, and in their own countries they sometimes, as per our research, sometimes they spend out even 30-40% of their daily income on smoking. And you know that in most countries these days, you know, smoking is not allowed in many public places, nor in the workplaces. So if they are informed that, look, this is one thing you should stop now, if you have the habit. And that can also deteriorate your health, and that can also not good for the receiving country. If your health is not good, you will be sent back, or if the productivity will be less. So this is one thing perhaps you can just consider including in the orientation seminar, that even smoking is not good at all, because this is also the gateway to all drugs, e-cigarettes and other things. Because when you start smoking with the group, then you can start doing other things in the group, and that is still not good. There's some of the things that you would like to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Kumar. Would you like to answer that?
Can I comment on this? Yes, I share my experience. That's why I say.
Do you want to make some comments?
That one of the conditions for us has been enshrined within the law, that we can only send our workers to the country when we have MOU agreement. Second one, when the country have a domestic law sufficient enough protecting the migrant workers. I'm talking my experience when I'm dealing with the country in Middle East. But I have to again emphasize a lot of successful story, of course, even it's a bigger number, but I'm just particularly talking about the smallest portion of this unfortunate and unsuccessful migrant workers encountering the problem. I'm focusing on this. For us, it doesn't matter whether 1,000 or one single person have the problems, it's the duty of the state to help them. So, in Saudi Arabia, I have experience, and I believe you know well also, Saudi Arabia has never signed any single agreement with any country about this. No. But again, we notice since we approach in many occasions in the spirit of cooperation, of course, because it's a business, we say it's good for the sake of the better relation between the two countries. Because if we maintain or we keep this issue, even only probably 100 peoples, but if we keep this happen all the time, it will damage a bigger interest of our two countries. And then probably they realized that 2 years ago, it is the first time in the history Arabs, authority in Saudi Arabia prepared to sit down, starting to discuss about this. And we have exchange of not already, exchange of draft, a draft for the MOU. But as I say, it's not that easy, because a lot of interest in there. We're talking about recruiting agency. As I say, there is a kind of collaborations, but unfortunately in a negative perspective. The lobby, the approach of this agency is very strong. That also affects the attitude and the behaviors of the relevant authorities there. So that's why it is very significant actually receiving countries also, if we can have agreement. Because no matter how big the problems from the sending countries, if there is no enough loophole there, it will not going anywhere. There's a kind of supply and demand. If they have a high demands, they try to find out their own way in whatever ways, illegal, illegal. And then another one I would like to mention specifically, if you're talking about Indonesian migrant workers, I'm talking about female. 99% of the problems encountered by female. About the male, almost we don't have a problems, because you know they're working as a drivers and so on and so forth. But mainly involves females. The vulnerables members of our society. This is, I think, my again, we try to have this MOU. As I say, it's a good example. So with Malaysia, we have already have that. And then I hope we will have more agreement with other countries. That's my comments for this. Thank you.
Okay. Would you like to make comments?
Yes, as His Excellency pointed out, that the dialogue between the receiving countries and sending countries is really the first step. And I have been actually studying this MOU in the region, and that the reality, and it was actually discussed at the last, I should be brief, was that this MOU does not really reflect the international elements. For example, the ILO has these conventions, and those factors are not, as a matter of fact, integrated. And I think that's one of the principal elements to the problems that were discussed today. Dr. Rahman, you know, rightly gave a very excellent point. And just to give a couple of comments to those, and you know, if I may, answers. There are no answers to it, because all countries are really you know, trying, and there are no right way to do it. You know, this issue in brief, this time's issue in brief, rightly mentioned that Indonesia, they use government. Nepal, they are 100% rely on the recruitment agencies. And the Philippines model, they actually try with the government, NGOs, and recruitment agencies. And I think the important element is that the government actually provides the right tool and right framework, better framework, to really integrate all the important components that will be of benefit for the migrants. And in that, you rightly mentioned that definitely that there is a scope to improve, you know, in relation to the cooperation with the country of destination. Definitely, they have to play a big role, and some components should be integrated into the programs. Regarding the role of IOM, of course we are there, you know, for the member states to provide technical capacities and assistance, as well as other organizations, UNOHCHR, ILO, some representatives are here. Some of the works that we do, we actually conduct a lot of cultural pre-departure cultural orientations for the migrants. Also, recently, His Excellency talked about the cooperation with the IOM, that together with the government we developed this handbook on the safe migration. Also developed a manual for India. There are a lot of initiatives that are coming when different stakeholders get their brains together. The Vigilance Task Force, and Christina, you can explain a little bit more on that. Actually, this is a very good tool that it's actually a program of Bangladesh. Different ministries in Bangladesh actually work together to really, look into what is not working in terms of recruitment agencies. And what was interesting, and I also brought up at the last issue in brief, was that they actually brought the recruitment agencies in on the table, not just talk bad about themselves. So this Vigilance Task Force program brought all these different stakeholders, including recruitment agencies, and discuss what's the best way to really tackle the problems in regards to labor migration. Maybe Christina, would you like to add some more?
Thank you, Yuko. Just a little bit in terms of, I had the opportunity to be working in Bangladesh for the past couple of years, and the Vigilance Task Force was established in July 2010 by the Secretary of the Ministry of Overseas Expatriate Welfare. It was established in terms of to do rightly, as Yuko had said, to really discuss the issue of some of the challenges that were coming up and issues that were faced in terms of payments and whatnot, and some of the challenges that the migrant workers were encountering, not only in countries of destinations but also at home as well. And it's a unique initiative in that it does bring all different stakeholders together. About 15 different ministries are there and involved, including representatives from the BIRA, the Bangladesh Association of International Recruitment Agencies, who is the umbrella agency of recruitment agencies in Bangladesh. It houses about 800 recruitment agencies, actually. And in that, Don and IOM has worked very closely with the Vigilance Task Force in terms of doing also working in terms of developing the terms of reference and doing some capacity building, and specifically what are the work plans that will be carried out. But it's an important opportunity in order that a lot of times there's a discussion in isolation, and a lot of times it was found that sometimes you have a recruitment agency and they can also have a travel agency. And sometimes if you have, in the case of something's been found, a license has been canceled, but the travel agency is still there, so you can open up into another. So the opportunity just to have a platform is important, and the ability to really get together to even conduct investigations into the health fields and looking at some of where those health assessments are taking place. And I think it's a very valid point what you had noted about in case of smoking. I had not heard that before, but I think it's very, very valid in terms of trying to incorporate that. IOM has worked very closely with governments, including that of Bangladesh, in working on the pre-departure manual and orientation to try to incorporate more aspects of health, even in HIV/AIDS, to try to inform migrants prior to going abroad. They've also visited the airport in terms of looking at areas and trying to discuss more in terms of issues of fraudulent documents. And we also had the opportunity of having other embassies come in and discuss, including that of the U.S. Embassy, for example, in terms of areas and what their destination countries and what the experiences are on the other side. So it's an important, I would say, committee that's established that allows and facilitates some of that dialogue, as well as for not only the origin country itself, but also the destination.
Thank you, Christina. One other thing I think that's interesting in this is how the whole labor migration is done, and the Indonesian ambassador mentioned Korea, and Korea is sort of the model, and I know ILO has worked with Korea particularly, but they have a government to government. And in fact, I understand Malaysia is now looking at a government to government relationship with Bangladesh to try and so. But again, it's the receiving country that has to want this, and when the receiving country like Saudi Arabia is not really interested, there's not much the sending countries can do. But ideally, if more receiving countries want to go to government to government, I think that's how you reduce a lot of the problem. Some more comments or questions? Yes, Ambassador, please.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity given to me. And first of all, I'd like to congratulate IOM for organizing this, and congratulations also for His Excellency Ambassador to Indonesia for the information shared. Just a small comment. I think it would be better also for the receiving, the sending countries, before they send their migrant workers out, they consider also the receiving country if they accede to international conventions. If they they accede, not only accede, but also how far is the implementation of international conventions like migrant workers, IOL, I think it's very important. Beside bilateral memorandum of understanding. This, I think, is very important. My comment, and just to share also information about migrant workers of Timor-Leste. We are a new country, but we do have problems at the beginning. So we lobby the receiving countries that have possibility to receive our people. But as a new country, you have workers unprepared. So the government has to take care of that. So the government set up a Secretary of State for professional services, and then coordinate with the receiving country, invite the embassy and the company in the receiving country that will employ them. So we have a meeting and an MOU with them. So things more or less run smoothly after our workers sent to the receiving country. Before, we have also a kind of pre-orientation, something like 2 months. But one of the things that is important demanded by the receiving country is also language. All the migrant workers, if it is possible, they learn a little bit about the language of the receiving country, so that when they arrive there, they can understand each other better and they are not easily manipulated. So I think this is one of the things important for the sending countries to consider before send out their migrant workers to another country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador, and interesting point. Particularly, we hadn't dwelt on much on the language issue, and again, language is a way to better protect yourself if you can speak the local language. Is certainly an important point. Some more comments or questions?
Sorry for taking again.
No, you're most welcome.
So we're talking about pre-departure problems. In our case, as far as I've done it when I was there, another one is kind of dissemination information by using media. One thing I did is I sent my staff to visit the pockets, what we call it, the pockets of potential migrants in Nusa Tenggara Timur, West Java, let's say in Sukabumi, Cianjur, and many other places by working closely with the community radio. And then we have a program to a kind of interactive. So we open up 2 hours. We speak a little bit about how the government's doing, how the embassies, consulates doing overseas, their roles, the function, and so on and so forth. And then the rest is a kind of interactive communication discussions, including even the one from the listeners' inquiries about the whereabout the fate of his friends been missing 10 years or more than 10 years. This is kind of things. And then this is one of the more the things that the foreign ministry have been doing so far at that time when I was still there. And apparently they have very good response from the public. We can see it from the SMX, from the response from the public, because this is life. And in Indonesia, you know, we have very good community radio, so very effective. And another ones that we have been doing, especially in our embassy, Singapore has very good programs. We call it the welcoming programs upon their arrivals.
And they have also introduced a kind of a capacity buildings. So, because in Singapore, for instance, they have a day off. And they open a program, even over for open university, for the workers to come to the embassy. And we have a professional instructors there, teaching and so on and so forth, including language training. In our case with Japan, because this is government to governments, there is a kind of language program. Mainly they demand or they request nursing, working in the nursing homes for aging populations. But one of the conditions is they have to speak Japanese language. And then they have a training for that. Because it's a bit costly if we send our workers there, migrant workers, to do the training in Japan. So the Japanese authorities set up programs. They come to Indonesia, and the training was conducted there. This is, I think, one of the programs we are carrying out, and also in many other embassy, Hong Kong also, we have a kind of welcoming programs upon arrival, because probably some of them didn't have a chance yet to have a pre-departures briefings or training and so on and so forth, so they can have that in addition to that. So again, this is the government has been trying to do to improve the system to better prepare our migrant workers, because as I say, prevention is much better than curing. One of the effective way to prevent is preparing the skills, the capacity of workers. You can imagine, for instance, if these poor workers come from the village, even during their lifetime haven't seen what we call the iron, electric iron, let alone operating it. And all of a sudden it's given this job. Probably one or two times damaged the very expensive clothes of their employers, and then after that, it's going to be. This is small things. Yeah. That's why I visited also several training centers for this. A lot of them are excellent. In East Java, they are working with a kind of internship with the local school also. I mean, we try to do all necessary within our capacity, of course, to introduce this kind of programs. As I say, it's not easy. It's very difficult. I mean, looking at the demand for this, you mentioned earlier one of the root causes in unemployment, especially in the countryside. That's why I say we are also trying how to create a kind of economic equality. We have very good kind of economic performance at the moment, but the challenges ahead is how we equally distributing this. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for those comments. And is there some more comments or questions from the floor? Yes, please.
The recruiting agencies. If does the government, the Indonesian government, like a training kit to deliver to the training agencies, like Manpower? Is there a guideline that they use? And another question is, I'm preparing a country brief for Indonesia, for the High Commission on Human Rights, for the Delhi Democratic Forum. Do you have any recommendation? That would help.
As I say, the migrant worker has become a global issue. Got people movement. It's very high. And now, the people traveling smart, easier, and accessible to everybody, with all the consequences they might bring up. So if you're talking about the guidelines or the programs for the trainings, the government set up a lot of training centers. And of course, we have also a kind of obligation for the recruiting agency to set up their own training institution, including shelters. Because not only, especially for instance, I mentioned, from the countryside, far away, and in the countryside, you don't have these facilities. That would be brought to, you know, Jakarta, for instance, and Java. It's a long way away. That's where they have to set up not only training centers, but the facilities where they have to cater them during their stay there before they depart. But as I say, responsible and a professional agency are working hard, because this is a fierce competition, it's business. while a lot of irresponsible agencies operating roaming around, they just make a profit at the expense of the workers. They don't care. This is the professional are complaining to the government, because why the government cannot overcome this illegal operation of agency, I mean, who create a lot of problems. We involve a lot of police. For instance, I mentioned before, National Board of the Placement, it consists of different and relevant authorities. We have the police there as a member from NCB. We have in international police, and we apprehended and caught a big number of them. But again, you know, the capacity of the state to overcome this is still not sufficient, but we're working hard. So the programs there, the institution there, but not enough. This is the second one, by involving international organizations like human rights commissions. I have one example in dealing with our problems in Jordan. Jordan, of course, have an excellent law under the decree of the king. Very clear. The obligations of the employers have to give a home, leave 1 day, and then if they make a mistake, they create the damage, the compensation, it's a kind of things. Under the king of Jordan's decree, very clear, very good law. And we have also MOU with the Jordans, very excellent MOU. But the problem is the implementations. Because a lot of, again, powerful labor agencies, very strong lobby with the orientation of profit, do everything they can to make a profit. And then we have a lot of citizens running away from their workers, come to the embassy. We have a shelters. We provide basic needs, sanitary. You know, you can imagine if we have 300 people living in a kampong, we have to feed them. We have to look after their basic health, especially female one. There are a lot of needs. We, as I say, I complaining several times. I received the Minister of Labour come over to Indonesia to discuss this, because we impose moratorium, yet the workers still coming in. They went through Hong Kong, come down to somewhere else, and then from there end up in Syria. Syria is not the country of destination. We have hundreds of thousands of migrant workers there. How come? It's coming from Jordan, you know, because they're just freely coming in. They have a visa on arrival. And then that's why we work with the Human Rights Commissions. There's a senior officer from the United States come, and then my ambassadors invite to come to see in our shelter the situation. And then after they see, they kind of, I don't know what the discussion they have with the Jordan authorities. From my perspective, I said kind of pressures. And then those who virtually taken a hostage, because they cannot leave the country without any exit permit, because they consider, you know, the breach the contract, because there is a police report. And then they're free to go now, some of them. This is, I think, one of the elements, the informal international organization in helping, in facilitating this unfortunate experience that encountered by our migrant workers in overseas. So this is one of the examples. Another one, as I mentioned, we have programs in Jakarta also, the capacity building, information disseminations, working with the university also, and also civil society, because we have very active migrants workers organization in Indonesia. One of them, you probably read, Migrant Care, very active. That's what we are also working with them. before they criticizing us, I say, it's good, we have the same cause, we have the same work, why don't we work together? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador. One of the points, I think, going back to the village level, that's important, is that anybody who's can talk very, very convincingly, come up with some documents to show that they're an agent with all these stamps and things, will convince some unsuspecting person who wants to go abroad that they can provide them with everything and take the money and disappear. So it's a huge job for the police to track down all of these individuals who can con the guy next door into handing over his money and then disappear to the big city. So it's a huge job. But thank you very much for a lot of good comments. Some more questions or comments? Yes, Ben, please.
Yeah, I do wish Dr. Marusha could have been here to present the report, but she did a very good job with them. I think one of the things that is a strength is that she does point out that pre-departure orientation programs really are not a one-size-fits-all undertaking. In the Philippines, which I'm sure was Dr. Marusha's focus, you do have this very solid cooperation between stakeholders and civil society is very strong. Our research on this at the Asian Research Center for Migration has primarily been focused on Thailand, and the context is very different. Our experience has been you get a lot of challenges created by conflicting agendas between the stakeholders involved. The government, the pre-departure program is mainly implemented by the Department of Employment in Thailand. But you actually have other stakeholders, the private employment agencies, and even workers themselves, in some cases, colluding to get around those kind of burdensome administrative requirements. So I think, in some cases, you do have to be careful how you implement these programs so that you don't encourage, more collusion between the actors involved in trying to use informal channels for migration as a way of getting around some of these mechanisms. I think just points to the importance of multi-sectoral cooperation on implementing these sorts of programs in sending countries.
Good, thank you. And some more questions or comments? Khalil?
Ambassador of Indonesia said earlier that some of your people go to country, the Hong Kong, without pre-departure orientation seminar. I think this kind of thing we should be very careful, because perhaps the country is okay. This is really dangerous, going to a country without having any kind of orientation. When you can't get one in your own country, to be in an alien country and getting information and orientation, I think it is really not good. So this is one thing perhaps migrants in the countries should be very careful allowing anybody to go without any orientation. Secondly, in relation to the orientation, and as I think this paper also captured, one of the challenges is this quality of the information provided at the orientation seminar. And I should add that the retention of the information given by the workers, usually perhaps it is one day or maybe a few hours, hardly these people really not very literate. They really can't retain any information given to them. So I'm just wondering whether any kind of short booklet is given on the basic facts on the country of destination. Suppose on HIV AIDS, this, that, so that even if they really can't retain anything when they go back, I think they have some basic education. So they can read sometime. It should be written in a very lucid language, very briefly, but very useful information. So that might be considered.
Yuka, would you like to answer that?
Yes, I think that, thank you very much for that point. I think we are currently planning to develop a brief booklet for ASEAN countries in promoting safe migration. So, you know, we can probably discuss that later on. I think there are a lot of important comments came up for the last 20 minutes. Human rights issues. There are, you know, the human rights issues in terms of migrants is really huge in the region. And when we talk about human rights, always the governance issues to be considered. And as His Excellency rightly pointed out, that actually comes to the problems with the implementation. So I think it is important to really, you know, have this multilateral cooperation, as Ben pointed out, is very important to really increase the political will, international cooperation, and luckily this region has lots of different arenas for that. For example, the ASEAN Forum on Migrant Labor, as East Timor will be joining the ASEAN pretty soon, I'm sure that you will be involved in this a lot. Sorry, for the declaration of the protection and promotion of the migrant rights, ILO, UN Women, and IOM are working very closely with the task force and the ASEAN Secretariat in actually implementing this declaration. The fifth forum will be coming out in Siem Reap in October. Right now, ILO and IOM and task force are organizing this preparatory meeting in Myanmar. The Colombo process and Abu Dhabi dialogue, they are two important regional consolidated processes that are very, very proudly to be, that are very proud here in this region that other regions can learn lessons about. The Abu Dhabi dialogue actually promotes dialogue between countries of destination and countries of origin, while Colombo process, as many of you know, try to really work together and tackle what are the problems for the migrant workers. And we are also proud to be announcing that there will be a high-level dialogue will be happening in next year, September, in New York. And we will be having, there is this UN thematic working group on international migration, including human trafficking, that ESCAP and IOM co-chairs, WHO, UNHCR, ILO are very important, the participants to it. We will be organizing a regional preparatory meeting in March, and we will have all the government representatives from this region, ESCAP region, to be participating. So I think it's, you know, all these programs, initiatives are important, but also complemented by these international cooperation that we cannot ignore. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, Yuka. Well, we've run over time a little bit, so if there are there any more burning questions or issues, anything that anyone would like to raise? Otherwise, we'll finish it here. Would you like to make some final comments, Ambassador, or you're okay?
Thanks, I think I have enough.
Okay.
Much of the time of our colleagues.
Well, I am most grateful, Ambassador. We didn't realize when we invited you to come that you'd actually been the Director General of the Consular Department, so you've got a vast amount of information that I don't think a regular ambassador would necessarily have, so we're extremely grateful for you giving up your time, and I think we've all learned a great deal here today. Thank you very much. I'm not sure that I can summarize very well. It was a very broad discussion. I think we touched on all aspects of labor migration, not just pre-departure orientation, but as often happens, we went across the whole gamut of issues today. It's something that's with us in this world, and it's not going to go away, and we can just hope that by all of these measures that we're all trying to implement, that governments are working on, that somehow we will reduce the exploitation and get more money into the hands of the people who actually do the work, and not all those people who are involved in getting them to the work site. So,
sorry, a few seconds.
Yes.
One aspect that one of the consequences of this is very touching. I have experience when I visited one of the shelters. Not only our migrant workers there, they have a baby. This is the problem source, the status of the baby. And then I happened to bring bags in one shelter, about 12 babies. This is another social impact of this kind of things. This is another aspect that, other than we mentioned elements that we need to also inform to our workers, to, you know, not too easily tempted with this kind of things. Because there is a misleading information to a certain number of migrant workers who work in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, say the baby they have a blood as a kind of a descendants of the Prophet Muhammad. This is a kind of, that's why they,
it's okay,
they prepare. They say, well, how come you get easily involved in this kind of things?
Wow.
You see, small things, because of the education. I just want to share, look small thing, but it's happened.
Wow.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that. It's human. It's human beings. Every single migrant worker, and there are millions of them in the world, are human beings. I'd just like to remind you all that this is Chatham House rules, so no quotes from anything you heard here today out of this room. Thank you. I'd also like to mention the calendar for the next. There are three more of the in-brief series coming up. One on the 17th of October, although we're not absolutely sure, but we'll email these out to you, or we have your email addresses. But that one will be on Thailand at a crossroads, challenges and opportunities in leveraging migration for development in Thailand. November we'll have one in diaspora engagement in Asia. In December, climate change and migrant rights. So you're on our mailing list, and of course you'd be most welcome to attend the next three, and hopefully we'll even try and get some for next year, although we haven't quite figured out how yet. But anyway, again, thank you very much for coming and making this a rich discussion, useful, and I hope you all take back something from it. I know, again, thanking the Indonesian ambassador for a lot of insights and a lot of very interesting, useful information on how the system works. So thank you again. Thank you very much. Thank you.
For more information on MPI's Migration and Development Program, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/research/migration_development.